Today at Reader's Corner, Christopher Steiner, author of Automate This: How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World.
An algorithm is basically a set of instructions that informs, usually a machine, of what to do with a piece of information. They decide what gets played on our radios, what gets printed in our newspapers. They decide what you read on the web. So more and more our world is becoming decided in all sorts of facets by algorithms. It's gotten to the point on Wall Street where there's so much action and the trades are so fast and the prices move so quickly that humans cannot wade into the mess and really make sense of it.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Each day, our lives are increasingly driven by the unseen force of data that is harnessed, organized, and focused by complex sets of mathematical formulas known as algorithms. These information age tools play a huge role in everything from the safety and efficiency of our cars to the kind of music we hear on the radio to the split-second trading on Wall Street that drives our economy. In his recent book, Automate This: How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World, Christopher Steiner describes how algorithms are accomplishing tasks with unequaled speed, efficiency, and insight in all sorts of fields. Yet this increasing ability of algorithms to assimilate data can mask their cost to the human spirit and the chaos they cause when they fail, according to Mr. Steiner's book. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Christopher Steiner. He has worked as a reporter for the Chicago Tribune and a writer for Forbes magazine. An engineer by training, Mr. Steiner also is an entrepreneur and recently founded a company that uses group buying to offer inexpensive grocery deals to its customers. Mr. Steiner joined us by phone for this interview. Christopher Steiner, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start with Algorithm Class 101. What is an algorithm?
An algorithm, I mean, it's pretty simple. I think people assume that they're these equations that are chock full of math and databases and things like this, and certainly they can be, but they can also be as simple as, you know, you can write an algorithm for, will I wear my rain shoes this morning, my rubber rain shoes? Is it raining? And the input would be, is it raining? Yes, I will wear them then. If it's not, no, I will not. So an algorithm is basically a set of instructions that informs usually a machine of what to do with a piece of information. So algorithms take input, they take that information, and they create output based on, you know, what is written in the algorithm. So a simple algorithm that a lot of engineering students have to write in one of their first computer science courses, I remember doing this myself, is an algorithm to play tic-tac-toe. The inputs are the moves of the human. The outputs are the moves of the computer. And of course, if you want to get a perfect score on this, if you want to get 100% on your homework problem, you will write a tic-tac-toe algorithm that never loses, right? It always plays you to a draw. So that's my simple explanation. And of course, they've grown to become very, very complicated things. I mean, they no longer are just these rote sequence of sets of instructions. At this point, you know, when they taken things like machine learning and changing data sets and all these other things, algorithms at this point are evolving, and they can evolve on their own. And in some cases, you know, it used to always be that we were the ones writing the algorithms. Now the algorithms write algorithms. And, you know, at some point, we crossed a line within the last couple of years where we are not always the ones shaping the algorithms, but they're in fact shaping us. I mean, they decide sometimes what gets played on our radios. They decide what gets printed in our newspapers. They decide what you read on the web. So more and more our world is becoming decided in all sorts of facets by algorithms.
Where do you learn how to create algorithms? Is that what you did as an undergrad in engineering at the University of Illinois, or is that what a mathematician learns? The folks that are actually doing these things, what kind of training or education is in their background?
Really, they come from all different places. Now, I was actually a civil engineer, so I wrote algorithms in a computer language called C. And they weren't that complicated. They were just rather simple calculus equations and differential equations that would take an input based on, and we designed, like, back when I was an engineer, we designed ski resorts, and we would have to figure out, you know, what different snowfalls, what kind of runoff they would produce in the spring. And so we would put different inputs, being the snowfall, the steepness of the grade, and we would write the algorithm so we wouldn't have to do these equations over and over again and figure it out. But typically, algorithms are written in a computer language, as I said, and computer languages really are just things, they've been built to express algorithms. That's why they exist. They're just a way to express an algorithm. And mathematicians certainly can write algorithms. A lot of them know how to program. And in a lot of cases, it's computer science majors or engineering majors. But you needn't have a formal education. I think some of the best programmers I know, or certainly a lot of good ones, don't even have engineering degrees. They just happen to get into that field. Maybe it was through design, maybe through front-end website design, and they just kept hammering on it, and they've become very good algorithmists in themselves. And it's just a skill. It doesn't take brilliance. It just takes practice like anything else. You just have to kind of grind on it.
You make your strongest case for the early impact of algorithms by your treatment of the financial sector's use and development of algorithms. How much of Wall Street's activities rely on algorithms today? And then from there, maybe you could launch into a brief discussion of Thomas Peterffy, who it was this guy who, not was, is this guy who some years ago figured this all out for the financial sector.
Right. Well, algorithms, I mean, do dominate Wall Street. They dominate all facets of managing our money. They've, in fact, taken over Wall Street as we know it. They make 70% of all of the trades that control things like your 401k, your pension fund. They control your money, basically all of it. And it's gotten to the point on Wall Street where, discerning order from this chaos that is the market has become basically impossible for a human. There's so much action, and the trades are so fast, and the prices move so quickly that humans cannot wade into the mess and really make sense of it, very few anyway. In some cases, it becomes so kind of crazy. The speed at which these securities are changing hands is so fast that sometimes the machines even get confused. And that's what happened on what we now call the flash crash, which was May 6th of 2010, when we saw $1 trillion of value on our stock markets disappear in 10 minutes. And, of course, nobody, including the machines, had any idea why this was happening, what was going on. And, the market did recover probably about 60% of that drop before the closing bell. But, I mean, if you watched CNBC that day, you could see the anchors, their jaws were just on the floor. They didn't know what to say because they kind of thought their ticker was broken. But it was just this chain reaction of traders in Chicago and traders in New York all trading, via algorithm, of course. And they just got in this vicious loop. And they were just trading down, 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 and a lot of the algorithms automatically pull out of the markets when things get so volatile. So then there was nobody to pick up this volume, and so everybody selling who had an automatic sell order in via an algorithm, they kept looking for lower and lower prices, but there were no buyers, right? Because all the buyers left, and so it just kept digging a hole that was deeper and deeper and deeper. And they've done some things to address that. They've installed these things called circuit breakers that will halt trading in a particular security if it drops more than 10% in, say, 10 minutes or something like that. But we have these weird blips all of the time. I'm going to go on a mini rant here, but, the automation of Wall Street back when it all started, back when it began 15, almost 20 years ago, was a good thing for the normal person. I mean, it used to be that if you wanted to buy 100 shares of IBM or something like that in the mid-90s, I mean, you had to have a stockbroker. You had to call somebody, and then, maybe they would call their specialist on the floor of the NYSE in New York and put the trade in. And then maybe 30 minutes after that, the trade would get made, word would get back to the stockbroker, and you would know that you had these shares. And then when you wanted to dump the shares, you had to go through the same process again. And, of course, each time you did it, it was probably $100 or more on each end because you had to pay your stockbroker. I mean, to trade a big chunk of shares was sure expensive, even a small chunk of shares. And then, by 2000, you could trade on your computer in your kitchen for $8 or $9 a trade. And that was because of the automation and the algorithms that had come in to do the work of humans on the stock market. That was a good thing, democratization of the market. But, we're still just trading for $8 or $9, yet volumes have gone up, speeds have gone up, and all it has led to is, in my opinion, volatility. I mean, people tell you that the market's more efficient, that, the average man pays less per trade in all sorts of fees than they used to. But if you look at the studies from Harvard Business School and a couple other places, the actual proof isn't there. We haven't been saving much on our trades for the last almost 10 years. So there has been kind of an end of utility in this race, in this automation race on Wall Street. And the reason it began there, and the reason, you know, so many mathematicians and computer scientists and statisticians went to Wall Street before they went into all these other fields that are becoming revolutionized by algorithms, is because the money was so big, right? It was low-hanging fruit and tons of money to be made. So a lot of these technological changes that take place in our world all around, they come to Wall Street first because that's where the most money can be made on them. But of course, as I said, Wall Street's become saturated with engineers and physicists. And at this point, you know, they're turning their eyes to other fields, medicine, music, all sorts of things are, you know, seeing their own realms turned upside down by automation and by algorithms.
You're listening to Christopher Steiner. He's the author of Automate This: How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. And Thomas Peterffy was one of the first guys to figure this out. Is that correct?
Thomas Peterffy is a guy whom I built, you know, the front of my book around, and it was incredible for me as a writer that I was, you know, he's no stranger. I mean, people know who he is. He's a billionaire. He's worth $5 billion. He's on the Forbes rich list, all that stuff. But, you know, for whatever reason, his story just hadn't been told, not, you know, in a widespread piece. And nobody realized what, you know, this guy had kind of been responsible for. And he was kind of the godfather of this movement to a great degree. And he has an interesting story. He snuck out of Hungary in the middle of the Cold War into West Germany, got a green card from the U.S. Embassy in West Germany, and got on a flight to New York and didn't speak any English. This is like 1965 or so, and ended up working at an architecture firm and then an engineering firm. And they bought a computer, his first computer the firm ever had, but nobody knew how to use it. They needed someone to learn how to program it. And so he volunteered because he felt that was easier. You know, reading the programming book in with his very stilted English skills was better than trying to speak English to his coworkers, and he could just kind of steal away and work on these programs. And after a while, he became kind of good, and he wrote programs, little algorithms to help them design roads and bridges and all these things. And eventually he moved on to a company that traded commodities, a lot of gold and silver. And from there, he started his own firm to trade options. And this is in the late 1970s, after the publishing of a theory of an equation called the Black-Scholes equation that showed how to put a real price on options. But it was a rather complicated thing, and it was very hard to do by hand. But Peterffy was just running this thing on algorithms at night at his house and would print out sheets and then go trade on the sheets according to the values of the options in the pits. This is in the late 70s. And so he eventually goes on his own. He does this, and he does very well. You know, he has a few people working for him. And then in the mid-80s, the NASDAQ begins to kind of make its rise. And, you know, they then had NASDAQ terminals in people's offices, and you could place little trades by hand through the terminal. And Peterffy figured out how to, in fact, hack the NASDAQ. And what he did is he took the data feed from his NASDAQ terminal, much like a Bloomberg terminal today, although far less advanced, of course, and routed it into a PC that would then suck in the information, and he had built a bunch of algorithms that would look for all the lucrative slam dunk arbitrage trades, and it would automatically make them and send them back to the NASDAQ. And the NASDAQ thought that Thomas Peterffy had hundreds of traders because of the volume that he did, because he sent so many trades to them. And one day, one of the NASDAQ guys came over to pay a visit to this, you know, growing customer of the market, and he said, "Well, take me to your trading room." And so Peterffy took him to the trading room, and they walk in, and he said, "Well," and the guy from the NASDAQ said, "Well, where are all the traders?" And Peterffy said, "No, this is it. This is it. This is the computer. It makes all the trades." And the NASDAQ guy was like, "Uh-oh. You know, this, we can't let this get out, that this guy's hacked the entire network, and he's making, nobody knows they're trading against a computer, a bot." So they actually told him to unwind the whole thing, and he eventually didn't, but it was this kind of drawn-out fight. And that invention of his in the mid-'80s, the hacking of NASDAQ, and basically led us on a path to where we are today. And I think, but interestingly enough, I will say that Thomas Peterffy these days thinks, also, you know, believes that, you know, automation, that algorithms, that the takeover of our markets has gone a little far. that the speeds at which you're required to play to make any money are just too over the top, and he thinks that it's more dangerous than anything else. Of course, it's easy for him to say, right? He's made $5 million, $5 billion.
Let's move over to music. You mentioned it earlier, Christopher. I'm gonna read two quotes from your book that are about David Cope. And David Cope is this musician, this music professor at University of California, Santa Cruz. He uses algorithms to create symphonies and operas. And at one point in your book, you say, "Where's the line between human and machine creation? At what point does an algorithm become an artist?" And then at the end of this section, you quote Cope himself. "Trying to replicate the human brain using binary mathematics is a lot different than creating it with cells and DNA. These are wonderful algorithms, but we may never do that." So maybe you could help us out with just what you know about Cope and what he's done, and this subject of the difference between machine creation and human creation, which really is probably a philosophical inquiry that could last three or four of these shows. But
yeah, no, I think that is definitely true, your last point. And David Cope is an extraordinary person. He's a computer scientist, to be sure. He's also a music professor, and he's a musician by trade originally. And he learned how to code in the 80s when he decided to learn how to create music programmatically. And he spent 20 years learning, you know, what is considered probably the computer language of consequence for anybody working in the field of artificial intelligence, and that's called Lisp, L-I-S-P. But I think, you know, he's a musician, so he is something of a romantic, but he's also a computer scientist. And so I think, you know, he's pulled in two different directions, and I think you see that with this quote, you know, "We may never be able to imitate exactly the human brain." And I think I would agree with that, absolutely. I think it is startling, though, to see how, you know, some of his own programs, some of his own algorithms have come, how far they've come in creating music that is original. But what does original really mean? I think that's the question that this comes down to. Because if you listen to, you know, any great symphony, be it a Beethoven symphony or a Bach cantata or something like that, I mean, they were all built on the work of their contemporaries or people that came before them. I mean, even the greatest of artists are affected by what came in the past. And so they make, you know, minute changes or, you know, improvements on what they've already heard, or they put two different genres together. It's very hard to say that you just made up music from scratch because, you know, of course, everybody knows that everything's building on the past. And I think, see, algorithms can do that, right? They can analyze the music, you know, in computer form, in its very mathematical, raw form, and see what it was, and combine different versions of different genres of music, you know, and tweak it to be just so, just like a human would. And that, in fact, is creativity to a large degree. Mm-hmm. I think where algorithms may fall short, certainly right now, is when you make a giant break from what we had seen in the past. If you talk about a band like the Beatles, you know, they drew, of course, on the blues. They drew on some American artists. They drew on Chuck Berry. But every, you know, 2 years, they would come out with a song or an album that was just, I mean, there were two leaps beyond everybody else. I don't think we have algorithms that can do that right now. If you talk about Nirvana, you know, a band that just, it of course came from Seattle, it was affected by the grunge music movement in Seattle, but they still were, you know, two loops beyond everybody else. They defined the genre. And I think we don't have algorithms that could do that right now, but I can't say that we will never have them.
Well, you use one example in your book of an algorithm meeting its match, and it's about poker. It's about sports betting, Midas, which is the creation of M Resort Spy in Vegas. Tell us the difference between an algorithm's ability to get its arms around Rhode Island Hold'em poker, which is three cards, and Texas Hold'em, which is seven.
Yeah, poker is very hard for computers because it allows for a lot of winning strategies that aren't, in fact, by the numbers anyway, logical. You may know you don't have the best hand or you have a very good feeling, but you may also know that you can probably scare other people out of his hand and take the pot. To a computer, that makes no sense. A computer is, you know, to a say, standard algorithm. The standard algorithm is saying, you know, one that's just based on mathematics, is saying that, well, I know there's only an X percentage chance that I can win this pot if, you know, it comes to a showdown at the end with these cards. And there's only X percentage chance that I'm going to see a card that's going to help me. Those are bad odds, because the average hand with this many people in the pot, the average winning hand is this, and I can't beat that. And the algorithm, you know, the standard one would just fold, right? And, but, you know, canny human players, pros, you know, will read their human counterparts and know how they bet, what their behaviors are, and will know when they can just push their way through to the pot. Or they'll know when people actually have something or when they don't, when they're betting high. And that's very hard to program. Now, they've begun to be able to do this. There's a guy at the University of at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh who uses something called game theory. And that's not, in fact, based all on odds. It's based on how other people see their own situation. And they've figured out a way to program this with machine learning and things like this. So poker is a game where the best humans in the world, at least in Texas Hold'em 5-card, will beat the best algorithms in the world. Now, when you talk about fewer cards on the table, the algorithms are able to eliminate a lot of the bluffing and whatnot, because there's far fewer combinations of cards that are possible.
One of the most interesting things about that section was the discussion of M Resort Spa, which is owned by Cantor Fitzgerald, the financial services company, and apparently they want to get into the sports betting business with using algorithms.
Yeah, well, they're in it.
They're in it.
They can bet on anything at any time. Right. And the algorithm basically, there's an algorithm that just runs the entire show. And literally, you can walk into this place and bet on, will this pitch be a strike? Will this next pitch be a strike? Will the Pacers score a three-pointer in the next 45 seconds? I mean, you know, the range of bets is completely insane. But it makes for a lot of fun, frankly. But that's just something where they have so many servers and so many processors linked together. They know the odds of all these things, basically. And the house takes, you know, the good end of the odds and gives the player kind of the bad end, so to speak. And it just puts all these bets up there at the same exact time. And it takes an incredible amount of computing power. But they've figured out a way to do it. But, you know, it's a nice way to pass. It makes watching baseball fun, at least, right?
So I guess, right.
Gives you something to do.
Right. You're listening to Christopher Steiner. He's the author of Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. Well, predictive events algorithms are really interesting, and you address this a bit in your book. I think you referred to the professor who actually called the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, these are algorithms that run, again, on game theory. And interestingly enough, the CIA had been commissioning the same professor from New York University to build these algorithms for them for almost 15 years. And when the 15 years was up, they were using the algorithms as just another piece of analysis when making a decision of what they might do about a certain situation overseas. And after the algorithms had run about 1,700 different simulations, they compared the advice and the predictions of the algorithms to that of their own human analysts. And, you know, if you're an analyst at the CIA, I mean, you are a very highly educated person, most likely. You probably went to an Ivy League school. You were at the top of your class. You had to make it through an incredibly tough vetting process to become, you know, one of these analysts at the CIA. So, you know, you're somebody at the top of your craft who's, you know, been honing your mind for 30 years. And so they compared the analysis of these people versus the algorithms, who don't know, you know, they don't know China from Iran. I mean, they're just programs. But as it turns out, the algorithms' predictions were right twice as often as that of the CIA's own analysts. And the professor who creates these things, so the CIA, Bruce DeBuena Mesquita, explained it very simply. He said, you know, humans tend to get mixed up in human stuff. You know, they're always looking at the back histories of people and how they got places. And they're worried about friendships and baggage and gossip, drama. And he goes, the algorithms don't care. They basically look at the situation very simply. And let's say you're asking an algorithm to predict whether Iran will announce that it has a nuclear weapon within the next 5 years. Well, the algorithm will basically weigh, from Iran's perspective, is it worth it to go ahead and do this? Are there more benefits to doing it than not doing it from Iran's perspective? And if the algorithm concludes that, you know, because of sanctions, because of Israeli bombing, whatever it might be, this doesn't make sense for the Iranians from their perspective to go ahead and announce this, it'll predict that they won't. It doesn't care about them puffing out their chest or being blustery. It takes a very analytical route to come to that decision. And it looks at it from the Iranians' point of view, saying, if you're you know, one of these people in charge in Iran, you're saying to yourself, is it worth it to go through with this? Mm-hmm. You know, is the autonomy we might get from doing this better than the possibility of being attacked? Mm-hmm. You know, and they'll just weigh all those things. Whereas, you know, analysts will get very caught up in, well, you know, they want to destroy Israel, they want to do this, they want to do that. You don't, you know, who knows what they're thinking? And the algorithms tend to ignore that, and it tends to make for better predictions.
So, Chris, I am just about out of time here, but I have to ask you about your company. You're the CEO of Aisle 50. I went on this morning, I put my email address in, I put my zip code in, and up pops all these deals at grocery stores, depending on your zip code. For example, if I was in North Carolina this morning, I could go to Lowe's and I could get a free liter of Coke, no purchase required.
Right.
Or I could go to Gordon's, get some beer-battered fish fillets for $9. They're $14.98 regularly. That's a 39% decrease in the price. I assume you're using algorithms. I don't know how many corporate secrets. I don't want to give away any of those.
You know,
but
it's a website, so we have algorithms. I think, you know, our most powerful algorithms are the ones that decide, you know, what deals you see,
yeah,
you know, based on, you know, the type of shopping you've done with us or with your retailer in the past. So we try to get deals in front of you that are relevant.
Right.
And of course, if we don't have data on you, you know, we show you what are just the most popular deals, right?
So you follow in other words, if I click the 1 liter of Coke or the beer battered fish fillets, you're tracking that. So you're going to know better next time what to show me.
Yeah, exactly. And what we track mostly is, you know, what you actually go ahead and buy. You know, I mean, if you're somebody who never even clicks or buys a baby product, you know, we're not going to show you those very often.
How do you know I bought it?
Oh, well, so you buy it with us. So you would buy it on our site, and then we load it to your
store. Oh, I see. I see. I got the impression you just went off to the supermarket and picked up your liter of Coke, but you're doing this.
You buy it on our website at Aisle 50, and then we load it to your store loyalty card. And when you go in to get it, you do your normal shopping, you swipe your loyalty card. The product you bought with us comes off for free.
I see. Very interesting. Yeah. Cool. How's it working out?
It's going great. You know, I think, you know, we're limited by, of course, our retail network. And so, for instance, in Boise, we're not live right now. You know, we're not even live. You know, we're based in Chicago. We're not even live there. We happen to be live on the East Coast. We're opening up on the West Coast next month. We're in Texas. We're in Oklahoma. We're in the Mid-Atlantic. So, you know, we're just trying to get retailer partnerships lined up. And we just think that it's a marketing thing, right? And I think we're using algorithms to put deals in front of people that they're more likely to buy. And by doing that, we're helping our clients, which are, of course, the people who sell the Gordon's fish sticks or the Coca-Cola or whatever it is, to get a customer before they ever get to the store. So, you know, they don't have to worry about whatever the competitor is doing marketing-wise because they can lock up that purchase before they go to the store. So, you know, I never thought of being in groceries, but we kind of... You know, we kind of found this little niche, and so we're having some fun.
Yeah. Well, we wish you the best of luck, and most importantly, thanks for writing the book, Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. Our guest has been Christopher Steiner. Thanks so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Christopher Steiner. Next week, Christian Carl, author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.